That's not what I meant. The Sociolinguistics of Everyday Conversation, Lecture 12, The Classroom, Talking in School.
In the last lecture, we looked at talking at work. In this one, I want to look at talking at school in the classroom. And I'm going to look at classroom, the whole range of classrooms, starting from preschool and going up into college and graduate school. We saw in the previous lecture that conversational styles can have very different effects in a public context than in private, although the processes are very similar. Well, our first encounter with public context is educational institutions, talking at school. And again, we find that contrasting styles will often work to the detriment of the people whose styles are out of power. In other words, in school, the teachers and the administrators' styles are the ones that are going to hold sway. And children, or parents of children, who have different styles are the ones that may find that they're somehow being shortchanged. Quite a lot of research has been done by a number of scholars on classroom interaction, and I'm going to mention quite a number of them in this lecture. An anthropological linguist who I've cited in earlier lectures is John Gumpers. He was a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who developed a lot of insights into how people with culturally different backgrounds use language to signal meaning and the effects that these differences have on how they're evaluated in interactions. Well, he has also looked at classroom interactions. And here's just, I'm going to start with a very simple example from John Gumpers' research. He talks about ways of signaling meaning as contextualization cues. In other words, linguistic cues that signal the context, that contextualize your words. Another way to talk about it would be send a meta message about how you're framing what you say. Well, here's an example that John Gumpers gives of two children in a classroom, one middle-class white, one African-American, and how the contextualization cues, in other words, the little linguistic signals that the white child uses are understood and picked up by the teacher, but the contextualization cues, in other words, the little linguistic signals that the African-American child uses to signal meaning are missed by the teacher, and so the child is kind of put down. This example comes from a taped elementary school classroom. So the teacher is having students read aloud. So here's the example of the African-American child and how the teacher doesn't seem to quite get the child's use of contextualization cues. So the teacher calls on the student to read, and the student says, "I don't want to read." Well, the teacher gets annoyed and says, "All right then, sit down." As part of his research method, John Gumpers played this interaction for a number of other people, and he noticed a systematic difference in how they evaluated this child's "I don't want to read." He found that white informants, when he played this, had pretty much the same response as the teacher. The child is being uncooperative, doesn't want to read, and the teacher correctly understood that. But Gumpers found that African-American informants, when he played it, heard the child saying, "Push me a little and I'll read. I can do it, but I need to know you really want me to. I need a little encouragement." And the teacher missed it. Gumpers claims that it was the way the child said it that showed this. "I don't want to read." If he wasn't asking for encouragement, if he really wasn't going to read, he would have said it with a falling intonation, "I don't want to read." But saying, "I don't want to read," had this different implication. In the next example, Gumpers is able to contrast two students, one black, one white, and the different way the teacher responds in the same short interaction. So first the teacher calls on James. "James, what does this word say?" And James says, "I don't know." And so the teacher says, "Well, if you don't want to try, someone else will. Freddie?" And Freddie says, "Is that a P or a B?" And the teacher encouragingly says, "It's a P." And so Freddie says, "Pen." Gumpers points out that "I don't know," in that tentative sort of way, again, was a way to say, "Encourage me a little bit," but the teacher missed that. Well, the way that Freddie asked for encouragement was something she could pick up. Is that a P or a B? So she was willing to give the encouragement. It's a P. And Gumbers points out that when children find their contextualization cues missed by teachers, in other words, James and the student in the first example could see that the teacher was willing to encourage the white students but not willing to encourage them, could very understandably draw the conclusion that the teacher just doesn't want to encourage them, doesn't believe they can do it. As with all the examples we've seen in all these lectures, we rarely think of contextualization cues or linguistic signals. We rarely think, gee, maybe the intonation with which I said that is something she didn't recognize, so that's why she didn't give me encouragement. So that's just a really short example of the kind of thing we'll be seeing in this lecture. Another linguistic signal that can result in conversational style differences between teachers and students is the use of gaze. Now, ask yourself, when you were growing up, were you told that you show respect by looking at a person? Look at me when I talk to you. Or were you taught that to show respect, you look down? You don't stare an elder or a person you should show respect for in the face. Well, there are great cultural differences with respect to that. So there are many cultures in which children are taught it's rude to look directly in the eye of a superior, an adult. You should look down, and that shows respect. So Hispanic cultures, Korean, Southern American would be many examples of that. And I've encountered individuals who have told me they were really caught off guard. I'm thinking, for example, of more than one I've talked to who grew up in the southern part of the United States, white or black, and told to show respect by looking down. And then they've moved up north where they're actually chastised for showing respect in that way. And the teacher says, look at me when I talk to you. And it's hard to overestimate the frustration that a child feels when he or she intends one thing and the teacher so fundamentally misunderstands their intentions. Susan Phillips is an anthropologist at the University of Arizona who has done research on classrooms. She actually compared Warm Springs Indian children, and this is in the state of Oregon, with Anglo teachers and Anglo students in the classroom. A pattern that she observed was that Anglo teachers often got the impression that the Warm Springs Indian children were not paying attention. And there were a number of things going on that contributed to that. Sometimes they really weren't paying attention. Often all children sometimes don't pay attention, but Phillips does explain a number of reasons why they might not. But there were significant instances where, many instances where the children were paying attention and the teacher didn't read their behavior as attention. And much of this had to do with gaze. So the Indian children looked at the teacher less, looked at each other more. They provided fewer back-channel responses. So, for example, if the teacher, this is elementary school children, if the teacher announced something that the kids might like, they would nod, they would clap, they might call out, yay, oh boy. And all of this kind of expansive response was much less forthcoming or common among the Indian children than among the Anglo children. And the Anglo teachers tended to take this as lack of attention. A linguistic device that we've looked at in a number of contexts is the use of questions. And here again, we find cultural differences among children as to their habits regarding questions, especially rhetorical questions. In American classrooms, you find teachers asking children questions to which they know the answer. It's a kind of testing question. And a number of scholars have pointed out that not all children come to school used to dealing with those kinds of questions. Ray McDermott is an anthropologist who studies educational context, and he's at Stanford University, previously a teacher's college, Columbia. And he points out how bizarre these rhetorical questions really are. You know, for example, imagine if you went up to someone on the street and asked what time it is, and they said, oh, it's 10 after 12, and you said, very good. That would be kind of weird. Well, that's what happens in the classroom. Shirley Bryce Heath is an anthropologist who has written a book called Ways with Words, in which she compares three communities in the Piedmont area in the Carolinas. She looks at middle-class white working-class white and working-class black families. She noticed a very interesting difference with regard to rhetorical questions that varied not by racial community. Obviously, none of this is racial. It's a cultural division. But the division was really economic, that in the middle-class white families, she found that it was very common for parents to ask children rhetorical questions, questions to which you know the answer. You know, what do we call this? The mother knows what we call it, but you're asking the child to perform in a certain way. The child performs and gets credit. Yes, very good. And Heath found that in the working class communities, both black and white, parents really didn't ask the children questions to which they knew the answer. So when the kids turn up in school and the teachers are asking questions to which they know the answer and they just want the child to perform, the children often were kind of nonplussed and didn't provide the answers. So the teacher would conclude that kids didn't have the ability to provide the answers when what was really going on was a lack of familiarity with this conversational ritual. I want to introduce another concept that scholars who study interaction in the classroom have developed. The term is participation structures. Participation structures. That's the distribution of rights and obligations with regard to who gets to speak and who decides who gets to speak. So a participation structure would be where the teacher stands at the front of the room, the children are quiet unless the teacher calls on them. Another would be small group participation, where the teacher puts the students into small groups and they determine within that group on their own who's going to talk when. Another would be one-on-one, where the teacher meets with a student. So these are all participation structures. And this term traces to Susan Phillips, who attributes it to Irving Goffman. And another scholar who has written about participation structures is Frederick Erickson. Now, we heard about some of Erickson's work earlier in my lecture on listenership. Erickson and his colleagues have also done a lot of research on the classroom. In one classic study, Frederick Erickson, together with Jeffrey Schultz and Susan Florio, followed one child in an Italian-American family, they call him Bobby, from the classroom to the home. In the classroom, and this was in Boston, Bobby was identified as a behavior problem because he would speak out of turn in the classroom, and this created problems for the teacher. The researchers tape-recorded interaction in the classroom in a math class, but they also went into the child's home and tape-recorded dinner table conversation. And they found that the participation structures in the child's home were such that in almost all situations, it was appropriate for children to chime in and just throw out comments. It was all part of the lively participation structure of the animated discussion at dinner. And so what Bobby was doing was taking the, again, we could use the term participation structure from the home, where there were a term the researchers use is multiple floors. There were multiple conversational floors. It was okay to talk to the person next to you or chime into the larger conversation. That when these habits learned at home were taken into the school, it didn't translate. And Bobby simply wasn't catching on. And I think children have very varied abilities as to how much they catch on to the different ways that these conversational rituals function at home and at school. So part of the problem was that Bobby was taking the interactional habits that he had learned at home with regard to multiple floors and participation structures and transferring them to school. And it didn't translate well. The result was that Bobby was getting misevaluated as having behavior problems and even psychological problems that were probably based in these different culturally based conversational styles. Susan Phillips, who did the research on Warm Springs Indian reservations, also found that participation structure played a very large part in whether or not the Indian children participated fully in the interactions. She found, for example, that sixth graders, these would be Indian children in classes run by Anglo teachers, participated much less in class, where the teacher was at the head of the class and the kids were all together, and also in small groups, if the small groups were led by the teacher. But they participated much more in one-on-one interactions with a teacher or in student-only group projects. Phillips concluded that this reflected Indian participation structures regarding turns at talk. In other words, it was very unusual in the Indian context for people to be in a group and for one person to have the institutional power to determine who talks. In Indian contexts, Phillips found, people had much more autonomy in deciding when they were going to talk, when they were going to participate. And so this functioned very well. This transferred very well to small group interactions in school where it was only kids and not teachers. And in fact, in that context, in that participation structure, the Indian students tended to actually do much better than the white kids. She also found that Indian first graders were much more physically exuberant than Anglo children in the classroom. And this is a really interesting point that I want to develop a little bit, because in many of these lectures, as well as the present one, I'm developing a framework where I'm saying you have a cultural contact situation where you take the linguistic strategies that you've developed in your community, your cultural context, you move into another cultural context, and you're transferring those strategies and they don't always work so well. This example is very interesting because it shows that when you have culture contact, when you have different conversational styles and interaction with each other, you end up with a kind of complementary schismogenesis. In other words, you're driven into more extreme expressions of the behavior than you would be expressing in your own cultural context. So let me read this example. This comes from Susan Phillips' book, The Invisible Culture. She says, when the Indian children are engaged in interaction, they signal to one another through gestures and body movements. They often try to make each other laugh. This can involve wide-ranging and inventive movements. They open their eyes very wide, move their heads in unusual patterns, make faces at one another. They show one another things, directing attention to a torn shirt, an untied shoe, a funny picture, a crayon held between the fingers in an odd manner. Often, too, they imitate one another. Thus, if one child squats on his chair and the teacher tells him not to, a second child will immediately squat on his chair while the two of them look at one another and giggle. You can imagine, by the way, how that's appreciated by the teacher. There is also more physical contact involved in the interaction of first-grade Indian students. Most of it is of a teasing nature. When standing in line, they push and bump against each other more. While they are seated, one may trip another who is moving around the room, grab his arm in passing, or block his path with his desk. They poke each other and step on each other's feet. Sometimes they even end up wrestling on the floor. They invade one another's territory. They hide each other's crayons and pencils. Reminds you of the Italian kids we saw in the earlier lecture. They mark and tear each other's papers so that assignments handed in have a mutilated appearance not seen in the non-Indian students' papers. In the cafeteria, one will take food off another's plate when he isn't looking, put it on the plate of a third child, and then blame the third child for the act. So she goes on and describes these behaviors that she found among first graders in the Anglo classroom. Now, you might conclude from this, gee, I guess that in the Indian context, kids are allowed to act up in this way. Well, not at all. What Susan Phillips found is that in the Indian context, Indian children are much better behaved and a much lower tolerance exists for any kind of acting out among the children. So it was not unusual in the Indian context for a meeting to go on for many hours and for very young children, preschool children, to attend these meetings and be absolutely quiet and still. So how do you explain this? Well, what she conjectures is that because the level of excitation, verbal and physical, that is expected and allowed by the Anglo teacher is so much more than what's expected and allowed in the Indian context, that the kids misread it as an anything-goes situation. Obviously, we're allowed to act up here, and that's what they're doing. It shows the complexity of cultural contact when you're looking at linguistic strategies and related kinesic or nonverbal strategies. So we're not talking about a simple matter of you take a way of speaking you've learned in one community and simply transport it into another, but rather when you come in contact with another style, you end up with more exaggerated forms of the differing behavior because of the interaction of the styles. Since I've been giving so many examples of negative effects of style differences, I want to point out here that style differences don't always have negative effects. Sometimes the effects can be positive. Carolyn Adger did a study of a multicultural classroom, and she observed a very interesting pair of boys who were best friends. They had very different styles, but the differing styles actually had a positive rather than a negative effect. One child was Vietnamese background, and the other was African American. She discovered and illustrates in her study that they had very different styles of argumentation, but the differences meant that they could both feel they had won. The African-American child's style of argumentation was that he always sought the last word. The Vietnamese boy's style of argumentation was such that he placed value on avoiding confrontation and winning over the long haul. So if they got into an altercation, either a literal one or a playful one, if one boy got the last word and the other backed down in order to achieve harmony, they both felt that they had won what they set out to achieve. And Adger felt that this was one of the reasons that they were such good friends. So that's an example of where the style differences actually worked to the advantage of their friendship. An area of style differences in the classroom that has received a lot of attention by a large number of researchers is gender in the classroom. In other words, what are the effects of female and male styles when you encounter them at school? A key book was called Failing at Fairness, and this was written by David and Myra Sadker. They found that in co-ed classes, girls often ended up becoming bystanders. Part of the reason was that teachers tend to call on boys more. The Sadkers found that teachers would ask boys tougher questions and ask them more follow-up questions. When they talked to girls, it was often compliments on how well-behaved they were or how neat their work was. Now, people have commented that part of the reason is that boys are often more physically exuberant, and if the teachers ignore the boys, they become discipline problems. And so that might be one reason that the teachers end up paying more attention to the boys. Some of it, though, has to do with the styles that boys and girls use and how they affect each other when they're talking to each other. An interesting study was done by Jacqueline Madhock. She compared 23 small groups of middle school students working on a science problem. She found that in groups with two or three girls and one boy, the girls typically would defer to the boy, and so he would end up talking twice as much as the girls. In groups with two or three boys and one girl, the boys ignored and even insulted the girl. So the interaction among the children, again, had an effect on the interactional power, you might say, of the kids in this interaction. Another way of describing this is that the interactional power that the children themselves created differed by gender in the classroom. Eleanor Maccabee is a researcher at Stanford University. Together with her colleague, Carol Jacqueline, has done a lot of interesting studies of preschoolers at play. She found that girls avoid playing with boys in part because they find it difficult to influence boys. And you saw this a little bit in the Madhock study that I just described. What Maccabee and Jacqueline found was that typically boys responded to protests from other boys, but they ignored protests from girls. When they put pairs of preschoolers together to play, they found that girls often stood aside while the boys played with the toys. So you might conclude from that, well, girls tend to be more passive, and this is a stereotype out there. But they actually found that if they looked at same-sex play, in other words, girls playing with girls, boys playing with boys, they never saw girls being passive, and they did sometimes see boys being passive. So it was only in the cross-sex interaction that the girls would tend to back off and appear passive. One of the most fascinating studies to me is one that was done by Elizabeth Summers and Sandra Lawrence. They compared two college writing classrooms that both used what's called cooperative learning techniques. In other words, it was a writing classroom where they had the students get into small groups and critique each other's work. But the two teachers did this cooperative learning differently. One teacher gave the groups explicit instructions about how to structure participation in the group. In other words, the teacher controlled the participation structure. The other teacher put the students in the groups, but let them determine their own participation structure. And there was a very interesting pattern that emerged. When the structure was prescribed, the teacher said, okay, you know, you're going to each talk in turn. It turned out that the women and men students participated almost equally. But in the unstructured group, where the students had to get the floor for themselves, Summers and Lawrence found that the women students took 25% fewer turns. They tended to acquiesce more, to be interrupted more, and to initiate less. So what Summers and Lawrence found was that the participation structure played a very significant role in whether women in the classroom participated as fully as the men did. A colleague of mine reported a very similar phenomenon in a graduate school classroom. This colleague wrote to me an email after the class was over because he wanted to avoid anything like this happening in the future, and he thought maybe I could offer some insight. He explained that he had divided the students in the class into two groups to analyze a linguistic phenomenon in two languages, and this is how he described it. About half the class chose analyzing French and half worked on Spanish. Richard, the only man in the class, got in the French group. He almost immediately took over and would ask me to announce that the class was meeting after class or even for time during class when he could take the French group aside. One time they went out into the hall, and when they came back, some of the women in the group were making wry jokes about, quote, executive decisions. At the end of the term, they were doing course evaluation, so I left for 10 minutes. On the way back, I was stopped in the hall for questions from two students who were working on Spanish. While I was talking to one of them, one of the women in the French group burst out of the room and walked past us, looking straight ahead with a grim look on her face. The student I was talking to said, "She seems disgusted." When I went into the room, there was Richard up at the board expounding while the women in the group sat in a little circle around him. My colleague commented, "I think my natural inclination just to let people alone might not have been the right thing this time." And I think this observation reinforces the findings of the study that I just mentioned by Summers and Lawrence, that if kids are left alone to work out their own structure, their own participation structure, and remember, this is something that worked very well with the Warm Springs Indian children, according to Susan Phillips' study, but in the Anglo classroom, it seems that left to their own devices, the styles that are typical among women and typical among men end up such in interaction with each other that the women end up becoming bystanders and the men students end up becoming leaders. I want to make another point about this that I think is really significant. When the men end up taking over in this way, we can't necessarily assume that it's their intention. Now, the description by my colleague of the graduate school classroom, it certainly does seem that he wanted to do that. But a young man in my class wrote a very interesting comment in a journal. This was a class in cross-cultural communication where I had the students at various points in the class break up into small groups. And like these various teachers, I did not prescribe how they should interact in the group. So that was left up to them. And part of the instructions I gave them was that they should come up with one person who's going to report to the whole class what the group came up with. And this is what one young man wrote in a journal. "We worked in small groups today, and for the second time out, I ended up being the spokesperson for the group. And I find this bizarre. I don't like being the spokesperson, or so I say. So if I'm exuding, not want to do the synthesis, how come I seem so perfect to be elected for the task? Maybe it's by default. No one else wants to. I don't think I buy this." This really intrigued me. This young man was the only man in a group of women. And I had noticed that in just about all the groups where there was one man and women, it was always the man who ended up being the, quote, spokesperson, synthesizing for the class what the group had come up with. And so the question was open, how did this happen? And we, if we had videotapes and audio tapes, we could probably figure it out. But according to this man's own comments, it wasn't what he sought, but it's what kind of ended up. And I think it's at least possible that either the women kind of suggested that he do it, or perhaps were waiting to be told by someone else that they should do it. Perhaps they didn't feel comfortable volunteering. And perhaps he felt that he had to fill in and volunteer because nobody else was. It's just a hypothesis at this point. But what I do find interesting is that and I trust his self-report on this, he himself didn't quite realize how he came to do that. So I've mentioned a number of aspects of conversational style that play a role in the classroom. And of course, there are many others we could talk about. We could go down the whole range of aspects of conversational style that we've discussed in the various lectures. The theme, though, is that the classroom, like any other public institutional context, is one in which work is done through talk, both in terms of the exchange of information and also in terms of the way individuals are evaluated. And here, as in the workplace, we're dealing with both institutional and interactional power. Institutional power puts the teacher or the administrator in control in many contexts, but we also have interactional power. From the perspective of interactional power, we find that children, students, college students find differential opportunity in the classroom. Although in theory, everybody has the same opportunity, different conversational styles result in different opportunity to participate and as a result to benefit from the classroom because of the interaction of different conversational styles. The next lecture will look at yet another public context, and that's the arena of politics.
This ends Lecture 12.